Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 21st of October. Gail Collins is our guest this hour. She has written, I've lived through this, so to me, all the stories are fascinating from all kinds of people, but a lot of people don't realize how everything changed for women in this country and for men in this country as well, long about 1960. And the stories that are in When Everything Changed, the amazing journey of American women from 1960 to the present are extraordinary. She talks about a generation that was born into a world where women were decreed to have too many household chores to permit them to serve on juries, and where a spokesperson for NASA would say that the talk of an American spacewoman makes me sick to my stomach. Those women would come of age in a society where female astronauts and judges were routine, and so much has changed since 1960. We're going to talk with Gail about this. She's done this great history of the women's movement since 1960, and she has lived through it as well. She is the op-ed columnist, of course, for the New York Times. She was a member of the editorial board, and it was the first female editorial page editor for the New York Times, first woman to have had that position. She has also worked as a columnist at Newsday and at New York Daily News, a reporter for the United Press International, has written several other books, and I think that she went to Marquette University. We'll ask her about that. So she's seen a lot of changes in her lifetime, and I have as well. And I just have a feeling that many of you listening have your own stories of what you've lived through, or how little, perhaps, your daughters and sons know about that time. We're also interested in finding out how things may be different or if there have been setbacks for women who are growing up right now. So we should have a really good hour. Our number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that today as well. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hi, Gail. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Marquette here in Milwaukee?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey. So,
in fact, you know, when I was this book begins with a story about a woman, poor Lois Rabinowitz, who gets expelled from the Manhattan traffic court in 1960.
Oh, my gosh.
Attempting to pay a ticket while she's wearing slacks.
Sent by her boss to do that, right? Yeah, come on.
Well, you know, when I was writing that, I suddenly remembered that when I was at Marquette, we were not allowed to leave the dormitory in slacks unless we were going bowling.
Oh, my gosh.
So
really?
You would have no idea how much bowling went on. You would have thought Wisconsin Avenue was just lined with lanes.
Oh, that's funny. I didn't know about that. That's incredible.
Yeah.
So you had to wear dresses or skirts all the time.
All the time, and it's cold, as you know well, you know,
darn
in the wintertime there.
Yeah, it sure is. There are so many stories like that in the book. I think that people don't realize, and even I was reminded when I was reading your book, my gosh, Gail, it wasn't that long ago. Things were so different for women.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, yeah. When I wrote it, I too kept going back and saying, oh, my Lord, I remember that now that you mentioned it.
Yeah. Do you think that we are sufficiently aware of our recent history? That it's obviously you think we're not, or we wouldn't have written the book, but that it's important that we remember it wasn't that long ago.
Well, I think it's very, I mean, for me at least, it's just, it really knocks me out. It just makes me so happy to think about the fact that, I mean, basically the way people thought about women in 1960 was at base the same way they felt about them in 1860 or 1560, that about their limitations and their proper place in society and so on. And the idea that all that collapsed, all those presumptions in my lifetime out of that entire huge span of history, just knocks me out. It just makes me very happy to think about.
You write about women in your profession. Women, this story knocked me out. I forgot about this, that women were in the balcony at the National Press Club.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't be on the floor.
And this was, not only was this the club for reporters in Washington, but it was also a place where many important people came and gave big news-breaking speeches. Sure. And although the guys there would bring their next-door neighbors to these things, they wouldn't allow women in. And of course, the women reporters protested. And finally, they said, okay, well, you can stand up on the balcony. There are no seats up there. And, of course, you can't eat lunch with everybody else. And it's very hot, but you can sort of try and listen and take notes from the balcony.
Oh, my gosh. Was it hard for you to break into the business? You were coming of age during a time when things were starting to change.
No, in fact, people, when I go around, often sort of invite me to tell the story of my suffering. And the truth is that I came in a window that had been opened by other women who were approximately 1 second older than I was, and that who didn't get, you know, the kind of benefits from their fights that they should have gotten, and instead the benefits went to people like me.
Mm-hmm. I remember I would not have been in radio if it not had been for affirmative action during, you know, the years of the 70s, because radio was not a field that many women were engaged in. It's hard to believe now, but there just weren't many of us. And
yeah, there was a strong feeling for a while that people, that women's voices were not strong enough to be on the radio. It often happens in different new enterprises that women are very active early on, and then when it gets really organized and starts becoming profitable, then they tend to have more problems. That happened with radio, with flight. All kinds of things.
Yeah, with flight. Let's talk about flight for a moment, because it is true that a lot of young women either wanted to become teachers or stewardesses for whatever reason.
Stewardess was the only job you could get back then if you were a woman that allowed you to travel. There were just no other jobs that involved travel. So it was back then incredibly glamorous. And you would get 100 applicants for every opening. There were schools that exist just to train girls to figure out how to get their applications accepted by an airline. It was huge. And well, you probably remember there were all those books, you know, Wendy Windsor Wings and stuff like that.
Right. And you had to be a certain weight and
you had to be young. A certain weight, and there were ads that kept saying, and you must have very white hands, which certainly sent a message, I think, to minority women out there. And you couldn't be married. And if you got married, you were instantly dismissed. So the average tenure of a woman in these jobs was about 18 months, because back then people did marry very early.
Right. And it is amazing to me how many women, you cite so many of them in the book, who were well-educated during this time period, chose to go to college, may have been very, very bright students. Some of their professors saw these great careers, but they decided that, as so many women did, they were getting married. They were getting married at 21, 22, right out of school.
Yeah, it was generally assumed that if you weren't engaged by your senior year, you were really a failure. In fact, one of the women I talked to who went to Barnard said that they'd have a party for the graduating seniors, and all the girls who were engaged got corsages, and the ones who weren't got lemons. And most of them got corsages. There were not too many lemons by then.
Ooh, not me. I waited for a long time to get married.
See, it didn't happen back then. And part of the reason was that there was still this sexual double standard that guys could do whatever they wanted. Women were supposed to be virgins when they got married. They were supposed to be chaste until marriage. And so there was this presumption that you needed to get married pretty soon before temptation struck.
Yeah. Talk for a little bit about the discontent and the book that changed everything for women who lived in the 1950s, who were raising children in the 1950s, as our parents were, our moms were, and what life was like for many of them. The routine, the laundry, the new appliances that had come in to make life a little bit easier, but these lives of, for many women, desperation.
You know, I had the best time kind of writing that, because I did get to go back and talk to women who had been housewives in the 1960s. And they were, I mean, no one had ever actually asked them before, so they got into it too, talking about their routines and what they did and how the ironing thing was just huge.
Yes.
For them. And you didn't have permanent press, and you didn't have automatic dryers in the house. And you went through this long ritual that involved, getting the clothes sort of sprinkled wettish, and then you made some starch with some stuff in a packet, and then you dipped the collars of the shirts into the starch, and then you ironed them, and then you rolled up the other ones so they didn't get dry. And it just went on and on. One of the women said, I could never get below 12 minutes per shirt. That was just my record, and I could just never get quite below it. So they, I mean, they were working. And, of course, most of those women in the 60s, in the post-war period, they married very early, and they had several children very fast. So you were often at home with, you know, two or three or four preschoolers, and you were really, 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 really busy. But once the kids were in school, and you'd moved into sort of the more automated machines and appliances that you got later, it was a strange kind of jump that had never happened before in American history or any history, where you had women in the prime of their lives who actually did not have enough stuff to do to really occupy them once the kids had gone off to high school and college.
Mm-hmm.
And that had never happened before. I mean, women died earlier, and they had babies until, you know, they went through change of life, and their nests were kind of always stuffed, or else they went over and lived with their children. So this was a big first that, you know, you're looking around and looking at it, I think was one of the things that sort of made women feel differently about their future, that the future was going to be there much longer than their families were going to be.
I wonder why people didn't think about that. It seems like such an oversight, because we are parents for, well, forever, but the big years are the earlier years. And, you know, after 18 years, your children are off on their own. That's just not very much time when you consider how long we live.
It's very interesting, and you could see, and during the 60s, you'd had all these, you know, women's magazines celebrating the housewife and the glories and so on, doing surveys about how they felt. But even they, you'd see in some of those essays, this sort of sudden, you know, and amazingly, these women don't seem to be worried about what they're going to be doing once the kids are out of the house. It really hadn't happened before. Throughout the 20th century, people were living longer, but we'd had the Depression, we'd had the World Wars. I mean, things were very... And before World War II, people tended to live together in houses or in apartment buildings, and grandmothers took care of the grandchildren. There wasn't that, you know, that moving around and people all living in their own autonomous houses and going off to different towns, and it was a huge change.
Yeah. I'm thinking as I'm talking to you about ironing, you brought up this thing about ironing and remembering how Mom used to, she not only would put the sprinkle thing, she'd put it in the icebox to make it a little bit chilly.
Right, because then they wouldn't dry
that?
Out so fast.
Yeah. But she did it very cheerfully. She really, and I kind of like to iron now. I don't iron very often, maybe once a month.
Well, you know, there is in the world people who like to iron.
I know.
iron.
Some who don't, my friends would say, you like to iron? I've never ironed.
But, you know, the other strange thing that happened after World War, so many, just the huge jump in the economy that happened and lifestyles that happened after World War II, and one of the outgrowths of that was that so many more families could afford to send their daughters to college just to sort of improve their status in life, I think, in hopes that they would meet a guy in college and that they would marry somebody who had a good income. And those girls went and took the same courses in college that the guys were taking. They did all the same stuff as if they were going out into the world, but they generally didn't then. Then they got married and went home as they all expected to and started having children. And for many of them, it was a fantastic life. And going to the suburbs and living with all these other women the same age who had kids, they loved it all. But there was a real substrata of women who just went completely nuts.
Yeah.
They had no idea. They were surprised themselves that they were so miserable.
Let's talk about the power of a book. Certainly, Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, a lot of people were reading quietly by themselves, but all of a sudden, here was a book that resonated with them because it's what they were living.
Yeah, and she had this very formidable style. I mean, she's a very kind of accessible writer, and she really went at it, you know, hammer and tong. And her message, actually, if you reread it now, is very modest. Basically, all she was saying was, we should be allowed to go out and get jobs. I mean, she wasn't saying overthrow the patriarchy or anything. but she was angry, and she, you know, was just going at it and talking about, I almost wondered if this was really true, about women who went so crazy that they took off their clothes and ran down the street shrieking at night. But it really, really rang a bell with this generation of women who had been to college. It was really specifically a book for sort of middle-class women who had been to college. It was not an inclusive book for the entire, you know, female race. But for those women in that position who read it, they would just sit there. Anna Quinlan always said she remembered her mother sitting in the kitchen just, you know, sort of brows frowning and reading away at this book that she had with her all the time.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, Gail. We'll take them in a moment. Gail Collins is our guest this hour. She's author of When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. For you to join the conversation. The liberation that countless generations of American women had been waiting for, whether they knew it or not, happened, and it's happened during our lifetimes. And when you think about it, it's a very, very profound change. So join our conversation with Gail, who outlines all of the changes and some of the major figures in the women's movement, some of the women who really broke through and it was amazing that somebody allowed them finally to break through, because some of the well-known people of our time were denied admission to certain kinds of schools or certainly to professions. They could be secretaries, but that was about it. To your calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gail Collins is our guest. The book is When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. Gail, of course, writes an op-ed piece for the New York Times and was the editorial page editor, the first woman to do this for the New York Times from 2001 to 2007. We go to phone calls for her. Let's start with Art from Milwaukee. Hello, Art.
Hi. Gail, this is Art Heiser.
Art, hello. How are you?
Very, very good. So wanted to just update you on a couple of things. One is that Marquette right now is celebrating their 100th anniversary of admitting women, and they're claiming, at least, that they're the first Catholic university, they say, in the world that admitted women. Obviously, there were many girls' colleges, but so that's going on. And you mentioned the slack issue. Among the many civil rights issues that a number of us addressed in the late 60s, this is probably after you left, I'm not sure, but there actually was a slack in, because at that point, the women could wear slacks, but they could not get served in their dormitories for dinner unless they changed. So we had a slack in, and that was one of many obstacles that was felt.
I bet that was one of the most popular of the demonstrations. I think that was after my time. But
a slack in. Oh, my. That's funny. Thanks, Art, very much for the call. What was the problem with wearing slacks?
Beg pardon?
What was the problem with wearing slacks?
They weren't ladylike. What Marquette was doing was very modest. It was, I've talked to women, especially women who went to black women's colleges in the South, you know, at that point in time, you had to wear gloves, you had to wear hats, you know, and my heavens, for church on Sunday, you know, they marched you up and down and checked you to make sure that you were just perfectly attired as a lady. It was very rigorous.
Right. Oh, gloves. Yes. Remember gloves.
Gloves were very big. And also, for women who actually went into the workplace at that time, to wear a hat was very important, because that meant you weren't a secretary.
Yeah.
And Bella Abzug said that was the reason that she started, you know, wearing her famous hats, was because her mother told her that if you had a hat on, people would know you weren't a secretary.
That's a great story. And we always remember her that way, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
With one of those great hats on. Thanks, Art, so much for your call. Julie is next from Manitowoc. Hi, Julie.
Hi. Two brief comments. I was in med school at Marquette in the 60s. There was a lot of criticism and verbal abuse of the few women in the class. Ironically, now when I go to reunions, a lot of the guys I'm glad to say, have daughters in medicine. So
all
that's
right.
great. But
that
what I
so
want to
cool.
really comment on is, you know, I really think the development of the oral contraceptive in the 60s really had a profound impact on providing women with choices. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. In fact, at one point in the book, I have my sort of four big, huge things that caused the change to happen so incredibly fast. And one of them, for sure, was the pill. Women had always used birth control to the degree they could, but the birth control that was available before the pill was, it was useful if you wanted to make sure you had only maybe 3 or 4 kids instead of 9 or 10 kids, but it was not something that you could count on if your thought was, well, I'm going to go to medical school and I'm going to devote 10 years to working my way up in my profession before I want to think about a family. It was just not possible. And as soon as the pill became widely available to single women, which took a while, that was really into the late 60s and early 70s, you just saw the applications to law school and medical school just shoot way, 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 way up.
Mm-hmm. And the other three big areas were?
The civil rights movement was just incredibly important. It made younger people question authority and whether or not they could trust anything that you know, their elders told them. But most important of all, it gave the country, I think permanently, a really great sensitivity toward issues of unfairness. If something was unfair, you could almost always count on public opinion to say, no, no, that's wrong. And that was huge for the women's movement. The women's movement really piggybacked right on the civil rights movement. And the first great breakthrough for women in Congress was an amendment to the Civil Rights Act that included women and the groups that were protected against job discrimination. It was actually added as a joke by a very conservative Southern senator.
Oh, yeah, tell that story. It's a great story.
Yeah, his name was Howard Smith. He was very old and very conservative. He was head of the Rules Committee. He was very powerful. He hated the Civil Rights Bill in every way, shape, and form. And it became clear to everyone that this was a bill that was going to pass and couldn't be stopped. But Smith then got up in the House and proposed this addition to add women to it, and instantly all the guys got up and started making jokes and laughing and hooting and hollering. But Martha Griffiths, who was one of the few women in the House who was just an amazing legislator, had known this was going to happen, and she figured if she could get her people together with the conservative Southerners, they'd have enough of a mass to actually pass the amendment, which they did, and then it went to the Senate, which the amazing, fantastic Senator Margaret Chase Smith from Maine took it up and just ran right over all the men. And it became law, although they had no intention of enforcing it at the time. It did become part of the law. So the whole Civil Rights Act was completely, completely important. And the economy was just huge. After World War II, there were not enough men to fill all the jobs. The economy was booming so fast, growing and growing and growing. And the men were, of course, all products of the Depression generation, which they called the baby bust generation, so there weren't quite as many of them. And after a while, there really were not enough people. And Time had a famous headline that a good man is hard to find, so they hire women.
Mm.
And Lyndon Johnson urged employers to go out and hire women. And he said, well, first you would probably want to try teenagers and the disabled and immigrants and all the other people. But if you run out of all of those, then try for women. And women respond. Women always respond when that kind of thing happens. And so that was the first step, really, in what became, you know, just the sort of natural evolution of women into the workforce. And the other thing was really all those changes we talked about a little bit before in the life of a housewife and in the sudden changes in life expectancy and living patterns that made it clear that you really could not plan on spending your entire existence as a stay-at-home traditional housewife for the most part.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Julie, for your call. Let's go to Anne from Appleton. Hi, Anne. Hi, Anne. Are you there?
Hi.
Hi, Ann. You want to turn that radio down, please?
I'm here.
Okay. Go right ahead, Ann.
Okay. I just
Yes, I do. Okay.
Okay.
I can hardly hear you.
Really?
Okay. I just wanted to comment that a big influence on me was the book, The Women's Room,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was glorious. And I remember...
Marilyn also, French, right? Wasn't
yeah.
it? Marilyn French. That was an important book when I was in college.
Yeah, it was a little bit later, but it was, certainly. I think every woman in the world practically read it.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, it spoke to all those questions of, you know, why are we happy here? What are we doing? It was sort of that post Betty Friedan kind of moment that.
All of those small questions: where are we going? What are we doing here? Oh, those days! I remember sitting around in women's groups talking about all of that. Women's consciousness groups. Remember those?
Yeah, they were. They were so. So typical of the women's movement as it evolved, in the sense that basically they were whatever you were going to do, and you know, in some places they were women who got together and plotted on how to go down and terrify the members' husbands at work and make them behave better, and in other places they were, you know, just sort of people sitting around trying to, you know, talk about how they felt about their bodies, and they were as conservative and as probing or whatever as the people in them wanted them to be, and there were no rules or anything, but they were a whole generation, really, just sat around talking about stuff.
Right.
And Nora Ephron told me once, she was really felt sorry for the guys who had sort of gotten married under the old rules. And then suddenly one day it was like, what did they do? What happened? And you know, they'd come home and their wives were having consciousness-raising discussions
right.
about... husband's
right.
failure to give the proper orgasms to wives and things like that. And it was just, it was a difficult time for guys, I think.
Yeah, a difficult time for guys, but an important time for women. I want to hear some of these political stories because I think I heard this sometime in my life, but you write about, who was the guy, they were trying to seat Pat Schroeder and Ron Dellums, who were given one chair as freshman members of Congress.
Yeah, it was the chairman, I think, the Armed Services Committee. And he was just—he's long dead now. But he said that neither one of them was worth an entire person, an entire vote. So he only had one chair before them, and they both we had to sit on the one chair and sort of squished together. And she said nobody really helped. That was an interesting time that in the early 70s, you did not have many women at all in the House and Senate, and. Most of them were widows who had come in to succeed their husbands. But when you look at the sort of who these people were, they were just an amazing bunch of women. You know, you had Shirley Chisholm and a little bit later Bella Abzug, and you had Pat Schroeder, and you had Barbara Jordan.
Oh, Barbara.
And Madeline
marvelous.
Griffiths. Just an extraordinary, maybe because it was so difficult to get into politics for a woman in those days, the women who did were just... absolutely amazing.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about Barbara Jordan. I loved her. Oh my, she could when she spoke, you just stopped what you were doing and listened to every single word. And she was, and we're looking at pretty early years for an African American woman to be given so much national attention, aren't we?
Yeah, she basically had a life in which she was the first of everything. I think she was the first African American lawyer, either in the state or in her county, or woman. And she was the first African-American woman ever to represent a defendant in her courthouse, and she was the first African-American woman to go to the state legislature and into the state Senate. And then there was one day, apparently they have one day a year when the governor and the lieutenant governor leave the state so the legislature can run things. And on that day, she was acting governor. So she's just had this huge trajectory. And I think there's a wonderful... wonderful story by Molly Ivins about the day that that she gave the speech in the Judiciary Committee during the Watergate hearings about how, you know, the Constitution had not been written for her, but that now she
yes.
was in the Constitution,
yes.
and nobody was going to mess with the Constitution
yes.
now that it was her Constitution. And Molly said that she was at the State House listening to this, and that you had all these very conservative Democrats, but they were conservative Texas state legislators, some of whom had called her the most hideous names in the world when she first appeared on the scene, as you know, because she was African American. Suddenly, all standing there saying, "Yes, yeah, give them hell, go, go, Barbara," and just totally rallying around her cause.
Yeah, I always thought she was going to be president, Gail.
Yeah, she got ill very early, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Yeah. Let's go next. Thanks, Ann, for your call. Dee Dee from Buffalo City. Hi, Dee Dee.
Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning. Do you hear me?
We sure do.
Oh, okay. I'm calling because I'm a product of all the things that have been mentioned. I graduated from college in 1950, and I graduated from the Alabama State College for Women in 1950. I probably need to tell you that I am Caucasian because I became very, very active in the civil rights movement, which has been mentioned also. I was also a lot of first things. I was the first medical social worker hired in a hospital. I was the first chair of a department at a certain small college. The first woman, you know, to do many things. You should also know that my first job after I had a child, which was in 1957, I had my first child, and the thing that my next-door neighbor, who was a manicurist, said to me was, Dee Dee, you have some credentials, and I don't, and we both need money, so why don't you get a job? And so I'll babysit your son.
Oh.
I set about trying to find a part-time job. I was determined I was not going to go for a full-time job, and because I thought it was important that I spend as much time with my son. The primary moving force, though, for me to get a job was that I desperately needed a dryer. I heard you say something,
yes,
about all the ladies who were doing the ironing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with a baby, I figured I needed a dryer pretty badly. I was living in Ohio at the time, and it was very cold. Anyway, I took the Ohio State social work exam and aced it, and then was called very quickly to interview for a job, and I went and told them that I was eager to have the job, but I would only work part-time, and the director said, well, we can't hire you because we only hire women full-time. And I said, well, I have a child, and I want to work part-time. He said he couldn't hire me. Well, he called me back twice after that to try to inveigle me into working full-time. And I said, finally, the third time he called me in, I said, I tell you, Mr. Olliman, that was his name, I can do more in 3 days working for you than these sweet young things just out of college could do for you in 5. And it would be a mistake if you didn't hire me. So he hired me. And I did enough for him that when I got pregnant with my next child, I went in to tell him I was resigning. And he said, he begged me, please don't leave.
Hmm.
He said, you've saved me so much money, by the way, in that period of time. I went to court and cleared 57 children who were in foster care to be placed in permanent homes.
Hmm.
And he begged me not to stay, and he said, I want you to stay, and if you'll just write court reports for me.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you can work at night, on weekends when your husband is home, whenever you want. And I stayed there until my husband's job took us to another town.
Hmm. That's quite a story, Gail.
That's, and you know, it's so, all the things you say about child care are just sort of the big, you know, undealt with issue that we still have today.
Sure do.
You know, question of who takes care of kids when you've got half the working force is now women. And unfortunately, there aren't that many flexible bosses out there like the one that you found.
Right. And it's such a crucial issue. You would have thought by now, because we've been concerned about it for such a long period of time, that many, many more businesses would have been providing child care, you know, facilities within their buildings. I don't see much of that.
There's not much, and they don't seem to feel that's you know, that there's that much incentive to do it. They there is in those professions in which it's really, there are so many women that it's really difficult to get good people unless you're willing to deal with these work family issues. You do like accounting. Most of the accounting students now are women, and the accounting firms are making much more of an effort to be more flexible, like your caller, you know, said, people who want to work half-time or people who want to do other things to make things work for their kids. Mm-hmm. But there aren't many professions like that.
Now, let's spend a few more minutes before we go back to phone calls on women in professions, because some of your stories are so striking. Supreme Court Justice and others who were the first women to break through, because there are so many breakthroughs. There was so much to break through back in the 60s.
Yeah, practically anything. And you do have some of the women's stories, the lawyers, the first group of women, you know, who came out as lawyers after World War II, are frequently told that, you know, there were no jobs for them except as secretaries in the law firms. And one of the women who I talked to came, finally got a job as a clerk to the Chief Justice of the Louisiana Supreme Court, which sounded fantastic until it turned out that he really took clerk literally. He wanted her to file and type every day. Women, particularly in law school for some reason, seemed to have a very tough time of it into the 70s, really.
Yeah. Thanks, Dee Dee, so much for the call. We go next to Irene from Brookfield. Hi, Irene.
Yes. I'm inquiring. I have understand that the Wisconsin was the only state to pass a marital property law. Now, the problem of divorce and children, I think, is interesting. You dealing with the jobs and so forth, but I understand that the marital property law has been eroded somewhat, and that there are people who work to erode it. And I'm wondering, since if we are indeed the only state to have passed marital property law, what has that meant for women who have been married for a long time and then divorce in other states? What is the situation there? And do you know anything about that?
I'm sorry that I don't know more about Wisconsin, but one of the interesting things that happened after the women's movement in the 70s was that almost every state passed, including Wisconsin, obviously, every state did pass a no-fault divorce law of one sort or another. And although the laws made it much easier to get out of a marriage, particularly if everybody agreed that the marriage was over, they eliminated a lot of the things that women came in retrospect to think of as protections. One was sort of the automatic division of property between the husband and wife. Another was alimony, although women didn't normally get it anyway. It became very specifically something that you only got temporarily until you got back into the workforce, which sounds extremely fair unless you happen to be a woman who spent the last 30 years as a full-time housewife and your husband is a lawyer or, you know, has a union job or something. It's very difficult for those kind of women to just sort of leap out on their own and forge a new life after, you know, 30 or 40 years of marriage. And the property issues became a big deal because you did have a lot of judges who just decided, and it's very easy for a judge to decide one way or the other, but who just decided that they were going to award the property to whoever they perceived as owning it and did not divide it between the two spouses.
Thanks for the call. We need to pause for a moment and we'll return. We're talking with Gail Collins this hour of the program. Her book is When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present, just been published by Little Brown. Gail, of course, the op-ed columnist for The New York Times, and she was the first female editorial page editor for The New York Times for a number of years. To you, more of you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls for Gail Bruce from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. It's a this is great to hear, Gail. I'm going to buy the book because I have four sisters. And in 1970, my oldest sister was 26 and the youngest was 12. And I was working in downtown Cleveland in the Terminal Tower, the tallest building outside New York City. And at the beginning of the summer, you know, the women, we all waited for the women to get into the elevator. By the end of that summer, everybody just went and came as they pleased. And that was kind of a watershed summer. And my sister would tell me stories about how she was an assistant professor at Brandeis and how the guys would assume she was going to make coffee and how she'd have to stand up to them. But my younger sister was always kind of intimidated by this. And I wonder if there was a reaction in younger kids that grew up while this was going on and saw this as a violent, unsettling time for women and then kind of retreated, you know, or, you know, because my sister was so outspoken about it and my younger sister was so young, I always thought there was a kind of a backlash.
What did happen to all the women of the next generation, sort of the younger sisters of the women who are out there, is that they got caught in the collapse of the economy, more or less, in the 70s. Their older sisters had sort of gone bounding around and just presuming that whenever they got done doing the things they do, they could find something to do and work. It didn't cost very much to live in the 60s. It's sort of a time of great economic confidence. And then suddenly, in the 70s, you had inflation and recession and loss of jobs, and of course you had the oil crisis and the long lines for gas, and it scared people. People who had been running around, sort of going to colleges, talking to young women about the movement, found them suddenly very sobered and much less interested in taking chances. And I think that was more. I don't know. I mean, whether that affected your sister or not, but in general, that seemed to be the thing that slightly younger generation was reacting to.
And what about the generation now, the younger generation now? And I'm giving it, I know it was a huge question, but how have they been influenced? Because I'm noticing, maybe just because I'm getting to be old and crabby about some of these things, but it seems as though some of the changes that were so much a part of my generation, not that they're taken for granted, but also there seems to be this weird thing going on with a change in relationships between men and women, you know, women accepting some violence in relationship, the display of bodies that, or maybe I'm seeing it in a different way. I don't know, but I'm wondering if there's still, if the groundwork has been laid and so women have it much better now, and they see themselves as equal, and they do. We don't have any of the sexism to deal with. It's all over.
It's never all over. As long as people are different, you know, things will never be all over. But I find, you know, and many people, older women, find it really disheartening that younger women seem to take everything for granted. But although I think it's really great if younger women, you know, understand all this stuff, because I just think it's such an amazing and wonderful story.
Yes,
but,
it is.
I also sort of get a kick out of the fact that younger women just take it for granted that they can do whatever they're going to do and that there's no constraint on them as far as their gender goes. I just think that's fantastic. And I've run into so many really incredibly powerful, dynamic young women out there. And all that said, you know, that there is a really disturbing, you know, sort of acceptance of violence against women mm-hmm. that we need to talk a whole lot more about. And, you know, I find it really, really, really disturbing that you can have, you know, R&B and rap singers who beat up their girlfriends and then go right back out on tour. And
right.
It's not a problem.
Right, and not a problem. My son and I were talking about that after that happened, and he goes to city school here in Milwaukee in high school, and I was appalled by that. And his response was, you know, all the kids in school don't think anything of it. They're, whoa, what's going on with that?
Yeah, I'm hoping that the younger generation, which will have a really long and serious discussion about the question of violence against
mm-hmm.
women.
Yeah. Bruce, thanks for the call. Barb from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Barb.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a lesbian who lives in Milwaukee. I've been a lesbian for about 30 years. And I had a radio show on another station called Women's Music Radio for 23 years.
Oh, my.
It was Sunday nights. It was an hour and a half. It started out as a half an hour show, and then it went to an hour and a half and stayed that way forever. And things happened, so I ended up letting go of the show. But how you know, I think that Milwaukee has had a really active lesbian community, and I'm wondering if you've seen that throughout the United States.
Yeah, it's very interesting if you look at the coming out of the lesbian community. During the women's movement, there was a great desire on the part of women who were lesbians to sort of create their own movement, and there was kind of a separatism thing going on there for a while. But despite the fact there were so many leaders of the women's movement who were lesbians, there was still a real sense of, this is a shocking thing to be discussed. I was so taken in the first edition of Our Bodies, Sisterhood is Powerful, where you had a lot of essays by different people. There was one essay by a lesbian, and it starts out with something like, reader, run, run, because you will be too shocked to read farther once you realize what I am going to tell you, because I am a lesbian. And it was just, you know, as if people were supposed to faint. And then very quickly, within the late 70s and the 80s in particular, there was just a complete coming of acceptance of this. It was another sort of everything changed really, 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 really fast. And then people started joking in the community that, you know, it's so in to be a lesbian, it's getting kind of embarrassing. It's, you know, Katie Lang, it's in the cover of every magazine known to mankind there for a while. But yeah, and it's not just Wisconsin. I mean, everywhere I go, I see tons of women from the gay community and their families, and it's just, even in very small towns, it's just remarkable how far and how fast that's come.
Thanks so much, Barb, for your call, and congratulations on that long career in radio. That doesn't happen very often. It's good. Anne from Rhinelander. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Anne.
Hi, I'm one of those younger women from Generation X, and I want to say that many of us do not take it for granted, the strong women before us that paved the road so that we could be where we are today. I went to college in the late 1980s, early 90s, and I was one of very few women in my college program, even at that time in geology. And going through college and then in the jobs to come, really, the men and women were very supportive of women taking on these non-traditional roles, and I worked with engineers and geologists, and now I'm in the natural resources field, where it still is male-dominated, but there's so much support for women in leadership. And now I'm in my mid-30s, and I have a high-level leadership position in Wisconsin state government, and I am not a week goes by where I'm not thankful for the strong women and men who paved the way for this reality for me. And I've got a young one at home, a four-year-old, and she's home with my husband, who is a stay-at-home dad. And it's amazing to me that I can be in this spot when my mom could have never have been in this spot. So I just wanted to call in and say that, yes, we people from the younger generation are very thankful, and we do not take it for granted.
Mm. Thank you so much for your call. Just what she said, there's the story. There's the story of what happened, that she can be top government official and her husband's taking care of their child. That's a whole new thing.
Yeah, this is a story so much about guys as well as women. It's far, you know, I always tell stories about guys I know who take care of, you know, kids. And I think especially when it comes to child rearing, men are really stepping up. I would maybe argue that when it comes to household chores, they're not stepping up quite as much. But, you know, I know, you know, many guys who just take the major role in taking care of their kids.
Thank you, Anne, so much for your call. I'm glad you were listening. Margie from Franklin, hi.
Hi. I was born in 1953. And I am surprised that this topic today has hit such a nerve for me. I didn't know that I had something festering under the surface, but you brought something up. My sister and I went to an all-girls Catholic high school in Indianapolis, and my brother went to the all-boys Catholic high school across the street. And my sister was 2 years older, then came my brother, and then me. I didn't know in high school that my dad planned on my sister and I going to the all-girls Catholic college in town and living at home. I found out about that when my sister took up the challenge with Dad that she wanted to go to Purdue University. Hmm. And she felt he had no leg to stand on because he planned on sending my brother Mike to Notre Dame. And the discussion in the house that went on about girls going away to school in 1969 was, I must, like the previous caller, I must have been affected by some of it because she was the fighter. And I just kind of followed in her footsteps because she went to Purdue, Mike went to Notre Dame, and I followed to Purdue. And when I got to Purdue, I just took for granted that girls could come in and out of the dorm at any time. I didn't know my sister was on the student council her freshman year and fought to get the dorm rules changed for women.
Wow. It's affected a lot of people in a lot of ways. Thank you, Margie, so much for the call. Gail, thank you for being
pleasure.
With us.
It was great to
talk
to you.
It was great. It was a really
hi
good.
Hi, everybody in Milwaukee.
Yeah. They all say hi to you. Hi, Gail. The book is When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. Gail Collins is the author, and she did go to school at Marquette. It's amazing how many of our guests have strong Wisconsin ties. Little Brown, the publisher. Gail, of course, the op-ed columnist for The New York Times. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Rob Schroeder for on-air production, and you for all of your calls.